Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Psalms chapter 36. I'm going to call this psalm, How Precious is Your Steadfast Love? Or in the alternative, as the Home of Christian Study Bible puts it later on in the psalm, How Precious is Your Loving Kindness? The heading of the psalm says this, For the Director of Music of David, the Servant of the Lord. So once again, we can determine, assuming the heading is accurate, that David is the author of this psalm. He's written them all now between number 2 and number 36, assuming that 33 is a part of 32, 32 being a Davidic psalm. 33 doesn't have a mention of David in the heading, but I'm assuming it's a Davidic psalm. So again, all these are psalms of David. We start now in verses 1 through 4. David says this, An oracle within my heart concerning the transgression of the wicked person. Now, he's not praying to God here. He's just making a statement. This is a song, actually, to be sung, according to the heading. An oracle within my heart concerning the transgression of the wicked person. There is no dread of God before his eyes, for in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to discover and hate his sin. The words of his mouth are malicious and deceptive. He has stopped acting wisely and doing good. Even on his bed he makes malicious plans. He sets himself on a path that is not good and does not reject evil. Now David pronounces in verse 1 that what he is about to say is an oracle. As the NIV Study Bible defines oracle, quote, an announcement from God. The word often suggests unwelcome news or judgment. And so David is getting ready to pronounce some unwelcome news on evil people. He says in verse 1, an oracle within my heart. There is a textual variant that says an oracle within his heart, i.e. the wicked person's heart. Let me read you the NASB translation that takes it that way. Transgression speaks to the ungodly within his heart. In other words, in the ungodly man's heart, there's no fear of God before his eyes. Now, Adam Clark is so convinced of this translation that he says it makes no sense. The verse makes no sense unless the manuscripts are used which say, His transgression speaks to the ungodly within his heart. Well, I guess if you take it that way, what it means is that the sinner's heart is striking his conscience. The sin is speaking to his conscience and his heart and saying, don't do that, this is bad. But the sinner responds by saying, there's no fear of God in my eyes. The KJV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, and the NASB margin have my, and that's the way I'm going to take it because it's just easier. Despite what Clark says, it's easier. The Holman Christian Study Bible translation again says an oracle within David's heart concerning the transgression of the wicked person. There's no dread of God before his eyes. Dread means fear, reverence. For in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to discover and hate his sin. In other words, he thinks more highly of himself, so highly of himself, that he can't imagine that anybody would consider him a sinner, including himself. He's not a sinner. He's not going to search out his sin. He's going to pretend it doesn't exist. Now, does not that describe the mass of humanity even today? Verse 3, the words of his mouth, the wicked person's mouth, are malicious and deceptive. He has stopped acting wisely and doing good. John Gill suggests that these evildoers used to be hypocrites. They used to act wisely. They used to do good hypocritically. Well, it could be, but it also could be there used to be good persons who got seduced to the bad side. We cannot really tell. In verse 4, David says, even on his bed, on the wicked person's bed, the wicked person makes malicious plans. John Gill's got a great way of describing this wicked person as he gets ready to go to sleep. He casts about in his mind on his pillow when at leisure from all employment, and consults and contrives schemes how to compass his lusts and to do injury to others, without doing which he cannot sleep. Well, David, as usual, makes a great contrast in his psalms, having finished with the unrighteous person. Now he's going to talk about the righteousness of God. Starting with verse 5, going through verse 8. Your loving kindness, O Lord, extends to the heavens. He's praying to God. Now, verses 1 through 4 were in the third person, but now David switches to the second person as he addresses God directly. Verse 5, Your loving kindness, O Lord, extends to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Your righteousness is like the mountains of God. Your judgments are like a great deep. O Lord, you preserve man and beast. How precious is your loving kindness, O God! And the children of men take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They drink their fill of the abundance of your house, and you give them to drink of the river of your delights. Verse 5, David says, your kindness, your loving kindness, extends to the heavens. Again, David talks of the mercy and grace of God, the love of God in the Old Testament. That should militate against the false idea that God is only a God of wrath in the Old Testament. Not only is God a God of loving kindness, his loving kindness is great. It extends all the way to the heavens. That means all the way up to the skies, maybe even up to the place where God lives. They had three heavens back then, the heaven where God lives, the outer space heaven, and then the atmospheric heaven. I don't know what heaven David was referring to here, but his point is clear. God's loving kindness is massive. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Sounds like heavens is in parallel with skies, and so he's talking about your loving kindness extends to the skies. It doesn't make any difference. The point is that God's loving kindness is massive. Your faithfulness, that would be God's faithfulness in keeping his covenant promises. Remember his promises to Abraham, his promises to Moses, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant. I don't know whether God has made the Davidic covenant yet. I don't know when Nathan came and gave him that famous prophecy in 2 Samuel 7, because we don't know when this psalm was written. But David is well aware that God is a covenant-keeping God. He says in verse 6, your righteousness is like the mountains. Metaphor is obvious. In the verse 6, your judgments are like a great deep. Now, what he can mean there, he can mean that the righteous doings of God cannot be traced, even as you can't find something in a deep ocean. A great deep is a great ocean, a great body of water. But, of course, the assumption is that before long, the judgments of God will be made manifest, even though they're hidden right now. Well, I tend to take another view of that. The other option is that David is simply referring to how many of God's righteous judgments they are. Not that they're hidden, but that they are massive. That would go along with the parallelism in the beginning of verse 6, which says that God's righteousness is like the mountains of God. David says, continuing in verse 6, O Lord, you preserve man and beast. How precious is your loving kindness, O God! And the children of men take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They drink their fill of the abundance of your house, and you give them to drink of the river of your delights. That doesn't sound like a God who's going around saying, God's going to get you for that. Sounds like a God who loves his children. In the Old Testament, it sounds like that. When David says in verse 5 that God's loving kindness extends to the heavens, that sounds like another psalm written by an unknown author, Psalms 57:10, for your loving kindness is great to the heavens and your truth to the clouds. At the end of verse 6, David says of the Lord, you, God, preserve man and beast. Well, now, if God preserves lowly animals, how much more will he preserve humans? And David was a particular human that needed a lot of preservation because he was constantly in trouble. And let's think about it. That's a good template or a good type, I guess you could say, of our lives as Christians, because every Christian's life is full of trouble and danger. I don't care who you are. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how powerful your friends are. I don't care how famous you are, how strong you are, how good-looking you are. I don't care. Everybody's life is a life of struggle and danger. But God preserves man. David doesn't even say preserves believing man. He doesn't even say God preserves saints. He just says God preserves man. And you think about it. There's a lot of people on this earth that are still living. And we all deserve hell. And human civilization keeps going on and on despite plagues and warfare and famine. Verse 7, how precious is your loving kindness, O God! And the children of men take refuge in the shadow of your wings. That's an image of a chicken. The little chickens want protection from some dog or wolf or something chasing them. They run under their mother's wings so that the fox or whatever it is that's chasing them cannot see them. I often wonder, why doesn't the wolf or the fox just eat the mother chicken? I don't know. I'm not that much of a farmer. I can't tell you. But at any rate, the metaphor is clear. Now, in the shadow of the Almighty is a famous phrase. I think a very famous Christian book was written with that title. Was it Jim Elliot with the Alka Indians? I can't remember now. The shadow of the Almighty is found in Psalm 91:1, the author of which is unknown. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. So you get under God's wings, there ain't nothing going to touch you. Not demons, not angry men, not wicked people. You need to get in the protection of God. And you say, well, but what about the people that were killed in the Olivet Discourse? Jesus said that some of you they will kill. What about the people in Hebrews 11? That, of course, is a big theological chestnut. The general answer to it is, in general, God will protect you, and even if you die, you're going to go to heaven. So just rest in the fact that you are protected. Most of the time when you're on earth, the bad guys aren't going to get you. The demons aren't going to get you. I mean, Jesus had total authority over the demons. He gave us his authority. We don't need to worry about demons all the time. Verse 8, David says, they drink their fill of the abundance of your house. That doesn't sound like children of men in general. As mentioned in verse 7, it sounds like saints, believers in God. They drink their fill of the abundance of your house. Now think about it. God's house is not going to be poorly furnished or poorly provisioned. He's God. He's got everything in the universe, and you get to drink of it. At the end of verse 8, David says, you give them to drink of the river of your delights. Now, I take that to be a simple metaphor, referring to the never-ending flow of God's delights that you get to partake of if you believe in him. Adam Clark goes deeper than that. He says that this is a reference to the river that ran. He says that this is a reference to the river that ran through the Garden of Eden. Genesis 2:10, now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided and became four rivers. Well, maybe. I just simply prefer to take it as a simple metaphor. David refers to all of God's delights as a river that rushes and doesn't stop. It's not stagnant. There are always more delights to drink out of that river. God will give you the desires of your heart. He's a good God. He loves his children. We go now to Psalms 36, verses 9 through 12. David continues, for with you is life's fountain. Now, if you look at a fountain, the water that comes from a fountain, it gives life. It bubbles up. The water is moving. It's not stagnant as it is in a pond. So God is like that. He's like bubbling water that provides life to the person who drinks. David uses another metaphor in verse 9. He says, in your light, God, we will see light. Now, what does this light refer to? Here's some options. Gill says it's the glory of God. So in God's glory, we will see God's glory. Adam Clark says it's the knowledge as to which path one should take. So in your knowledge, God, we will see knowledge. We will know where we're going. Light gives understanding. It could be cognitive understanding, mental understanding. It could be spiritual understanding. It could be intuitive understanding. But whatever kind of understanding it is, it's light. We understand when we see God's light because we're in his light. When we are in his light, we then use that light to have light for ourselves. His light becomes our light. Adam Clark suggests another possibility of the interpretation of light. Clark says that the knowledge of our deformities and need of salvation will be exposed by God's light. And so in God's light, we will see our sins. Well, that's true, but I don't think that's what David meant here. I think he's just talking about blessings. He's just talking about all the blessings that come from the river of God. And it is a blessing to have your sin exposed. I realize that, but it's just sort of negative in the context here, so I'm not going to take it that way. And then in verse 10, David continues, spread your faithful love over those who know you and your righteousness over the upright in heart. Notice that God loves those who know him, and then what follows from that knowledge of God? God's righteousness is spread over the upright in heart. So we know God and we partake of his righteousness, and our sin is covered. Now this verse is an antidote to anybody who might think that David is works-oriented and self-righteous, because some of his psalms sound that way. I've talked about that many times as we've gone through the psalms. No, David is humble. He realizes that his righteousness does not come from his flesh. He says your righteousness will be spread over the upright in heart. And of course, he's assuming he himself is an upright in heart, but he says it's God's righteousness that comes over me. It's not my righteousness that provokes God's love. God is the primary active agent here. Spread your faithful love over those who know you. And of course, the know there, it's not just a cognitive knowledge. Adam, New Eve, it means a close, personal relationship kind of knowledge. We know God not because that he's up there and he's a big, big, powerful God. No, we know him because we know him personally. David says in verse 11, "Do not let the foot of the arrogant man come near me, or the hand of the wicked one drive me away." He uses a little physical metaphor here, foot and hand. He doesn't want the foot of the arrogant, evil, wicked man to even walk near him. And he doesn't want the hand of said person to strike at David and drive David away, i.e. drive him away from God. There's again another example of Hebrew parallelism there, foot and hand. You see it everywhere in the Old Testament. Verse 12, "There the evildoers fall. They have been thrown down and cannot rise." Now, where is there? There doesn't seem to be a referent here to there. Well, here's some options. Gill suggests hell. In hell the evildoers fall. They have been thrown down to hell and cannot rise. Here's another suggestion by Gill. The pit that they have done for others. This pit has been mentioned several times in previous Psalms. In the pit that the evildoers dug for other people, there in that pit the evildoers have fallen, and they cannot rise. Or, this is my option, option number three, David is just generally pointing downward to a place on the ground, poetically speaking. He's not really saying there is a particular place. He's just saying, the foot of the arrogant man has come near me, wants to come near me. Don't let that happen. His hand wants to slap me in the face. Don't let that happen. But there the evildoers are. The there is where the evildoers have fallen, wherever it is, and there we can look at it and say, there they are, fallen down, cannot rise. That's the easiest way to interpret it, in my opinion. Now, Adam Clark gives a fourth possible interpretation. He says the there is the pride spoken of in the preceding verse. In verse 11, David has said, "Do not let the foot of the arrogant man or the prideful man come near me." And then in verse 12, according to this interpretation, the there where the evildoers have fallen is in the midst of their pride. The there where the evildoers have fallen is in the midst of their pride. Here's a quote from Clark backing that up. There has been applied by many of the fathers to the pride spoken of in the preceding verse. There, in or by pride, says Augustine, do all sinners perish. There in heaven have the evil angels. In other words, there in pride. In heaven the evil angels have fallen through pride, says St. Jerome. There, in paradise, have our first parents fallen. Adam and Eve fell in the Garden of Eden through pride and disobedience. There, in hell, have the proud and disobedient angels been precipitated. Eusebius of Caesarea suggests that. There, by pride, have the persecutors brought God's judgments upon themselves. Well, that's nice. All of it's true. As to what David actually meant, I don't know. He very well could have meant their pride. The wicked and arrogant people's pride is where they fell. At any rate, this psalm ends on a positive note. Believers get light. We get to drink out of God's fountain. We get to drink out of the river of God's delights. His faithfulness is high as the mountains, faithfulness to us. He preserves us. We can take refuge in the shadow of his wings. We can drink from the fill of the abundance of God's house. You can do that, or you can be an evil person who falls there in his pride and ends up going to hell. Pretty black and white. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Psalms 36. We are now ready to go to Psalms 37 in our next audio, which I will entitle, "He Will Not Forsake His Saints." I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.